Disc 5.
Hook watched the riders gallop down the hill and onto the flat ground, then saw the great blossom of black smoke billow and grow from Arfleur's wall. A few seconds later, the sound of the gun punched the summer air, a flat crack that seemed to linger in the bowl of the hills in which the port was built. The gunstone struck the meadows where the horsemen rode, ricocheted upwards in a flurry of turf, then plunged harmlessly into the trees beyond. And Arfleur was under siege. It seemed to Hook that he never stopped digging in the first few days of the siege. It was midden trenches first.
Oramar fell into a shit pit once, Tom Scarlet said. She was drunk. She dropped some beads in it and then tried to fish them out with a rake.
They were nice beads, Matthew Scarlet put in. Bits of old silver, weren't they?
Coins, his twin said, which our dad found in a buried jar. He bored them through and hung them on a scrap of bowstring.
Which broke, Matt said.
So Ma tried to fish him out with a rake, Tom picked up the tale, and fell right in head first.
She got the beads back, Matt said.
She sobered up quick enough, Tom Scarlet went on, but she couldn't stop laughing. Our dad took her down the duck pond and pushed her in. He made her take all her clothes off, and then the ducks all flew away. They would, wouldn't they? A naked woman splashing about and laughing. Whole village was laughing.
The first thing the king had ordered was the burning of the houses outside the town's walls, so that nothing would stand between the ramparts and his guns. The job was done at night, so that the flames burst into the darkness to light the defiant banners on Arfleur's pale walls. And all next day the smoke of the smouldering buildings lingered in the flooded bowl of hills that cradled the port and reminded Hook of the smoke that had veiled the land around Soissons.
"Course the priest wasn't happy," Matthew Scarlet continued his brother's story. "But our parish priest always was a rank piece of piss. He had our mother up in front of the manor court, breaking the peace, he said, but his lordship gave her 3 shillings to buy cloth for new clothes and a kiss for being happy. He said she could go swimming in his shit any time she wanted."
"Did she ever?" Peter Scoyle asked.
Scoyle was a rarity, a bowman born and bred in London. He had been a comb-maker's apprentice, and had been convicted of causing a murderous affray, but had been pardoned on condition that he served in the king's army.
"She never did," Tom Scarlet said. "She always said that one bath in shit was enough for a lifetime."
"One bath is enough for any lifetime,"
Father Christopher had evidently heard the twins telling their tale.
"Beware of cleanliness, boys. The blessed Saint Jerome warns us that a clean body means an unclean soul, and the holy Saint Agnes was proud of never having washed in her life."
"Melisande won't approve," Hook said. "She likes being clean."
"Warn her," Father Christopher said seriously. "The physicians all agree, Hook, that washing weakens the skin. It lets in disease."
Then, when the pits were dug, Hook and 100 other archers rode north up the valley of the River Lazard and dug again, this time making a great dam across the valley. They demolished 12 half-timbered houses in a village and used the beams to strengthen the huge earthen bank that stopped up the river. The Lazard was small and the summer had been dry, but it still took 4 days of hard digging to make a barrier high enough to divert most of the river water westwards. By the time Hook and his companions went back to Arfleur, the floodwaters had partly subsided, though the ground about the town was still waterlogged, and the river itself still spilled over its banks to make a wide lake north of the town. Next they dug pits for guns. 2 cannon, one called Londoner because the citizens of London had paid for it, were already in place, and their gun stones were biting at the huge bastion the defenders had built outside the Lure Gate. The Duke of Clarence, who was the king's brother, had marched clear around the town, and his forces, which were 1/3 of the English army, were attacking Arfleur's eastern side. They had their own guns that had been fortuitously captured from a supply convoy making for Arfleur. The Dutch gunners hired to defend Arfleur from its English enemies happily took English coin and turned their cannon against the town's defenders. Arfleur was surrounded now. No more reinforcements could reach the town unless they fought their way past the English army or sailed past the fleet of royal warships that guarded the harbour entrance. On the day that the gun pits were finished, Hook and 40 other archers climbed the hill to the west of the encampment, following the road by which the army had approached Arfleur. Huge oaks lined the nearest crest, and they were ordered to fell those trees and lop off the straightest limbs, which were to be sawn to the length of a bow stave and loaded onto wagons. The day was hot. A half-dozen archers stayed by the road with the huge two-handled swords, while the rest spread along the crest. Peter Goddington marked the trees he wanted felled, and assigned a pair of archers to each. Hook and Will o' the Dale were almost the furthest south, with only the Scarlet twins closer to the sea. Melisande was with Hook. Her hands were raw from washing clothes, and there were still more clothes to be boiled and scrubbed back in the encampment, but Sir John's steward had let her accompany Hook. She carried the small crossbow on her back and never left Sir John's company without the weapon.
"I will shoot the priest if he touches me," she had told Hook. "And I'll shoot his friends."
Hook had nodded, but said nothing. She might, he thought, shoot one of them, but the weapon took so long to reload that she had no chance of defending herself against more than one man. The trees muffled the occasional sound of a cannon firing and dulled the crash of the gunstone striking home on Harfleur's walls. The axes were loud.
"Why did we come so far from the camp?" Melisande asked.
"Because we've chopped down all the big trees that are closer," Hook said.
He was stripped to the waist, his huge muscles driving the axe deep into an oak's trunk so that the chips flew.
"And we're not that far away from the camp," Will o' the Dale added.
He was standing back, letting Hook do the work, and Hook did not mind. He was used to wielding a forester's axe. Melisande spanned the crossbow. She found it hard work, but she would not let Hook or Will help her crank the twin handles. She was sweating by the time the pawl clicked to hold the cord under its full tension. She laid a bolt in the groove, then aimed at a tree no more than 10 paces away. She frowned, bit her lower lip, then pulled the trigger and watched as the bolt flew a yard wide to skitter through the undergrowth beyond.
"Don't laugh,"
she said before either man had any chance to laugh.
"I'm not laughing," Hook said, grinning at Will.
"I wouldn't dare," Will said.
"I will learn," Melisande said.
"You learn better if you keep your eyes open," Hook said.
"It's hard," she said.
"Look down the arrow," Will advised her.
"Hold the bow firm and pull the trigger nice and slowly. And may God bless you when you shoot,"
he added the last words in Father Christopher's sly voice. She nodded, then cranked the bow again. It took a long time before it clicked. Then instead of shooting it, she laid the weapon on the leaf mould and just watched Hook, and she thought how he made felling a great oak look easy, just as he made shooting a bow seem simple.
"I'll see if the twins need help," Will o' the Dale said, "because you don't, Nick."
"I don't," Hook agreed, "so go and help them. They're full of sons, which means they've never done a proper day's work in their lives."
Will picked up his axe, his arrow bag and his cased bow and disappeared among the southern trees. Melisande watched him go, then looked down at the cocked crossbow, as though she had never seen such a thing before.
"Father Christopher was talking to me," she said quietly.
"Was he?" Hook asked.
He looked up at the tree, then back to the cut he had made.
"This great thing will fall in a minute," he warned her.
He went to the back side of the trunk and buried the axe in the wood. He wrenched the blade free.
"So what did Father Christopher want?"
"He wanted to know if we would marry."
"Us? Marry?"
The axe chopped again, and a wedge of wood came away when Hook pulled the blade back. Any moment now, he thought, he could sense the tension in the oak, the silent tearing of the timber that preceded the tree's death. He stepped away to stand beside Melisande, who was well clear of the trunk. He noticed the crossbow was still cocked, and almost told her that she would weaken the weapon by leaving the shank stressed, but then decided that might not be a bad thing. A weakened shank would make it easier for her to span.
"Marry," he said again.
"That's what he said."
"What did you say?"
"I didn't know," she said, staring at the ground. "Maybe."
"Maybe,"
Hook echoed her, and just then the timber cracked and ripped and the huge oak fell, slowly at first, then faster as it crashed through leaves and branches to shudder down. Birds shrieked. For a moment the woods were full of alarm, then all that was left was the ringing sound of the other axes along the ridge.
"I think, maybe," Hook said slowly, "that it's a good idea."
"You do?"
He nodded.
"I do."
She looked at him, said nothing for a while, then picked up the crossbow.
I look down the arrow, she said, and hold the bow tight.
And you squeeze gently, he said. Hold your breath while you squeeze, and don't look at the bolt. Just look at the place where you want the bolt to go. She nodded, laid a bolt in the groove, and aimed at the same tree she'd missed before. It was a couple of paces closer now. He watched her, saw the concentration on her face, and saw her flinch in anticipation of the weapon's kick. She held her breath, closed her eyes and pulled the trigger, and the bolt flashed past the tree's edge and vanished down the gentle farther slope. Melisande stared forlorn at where it had gone.
You haven't got that many bolts, Hook said, and those are special.
Special?
They're smaller than most, he said. They're made specially to fit that bow.
I should find the ones I shot.
He grinned.
I'll chop off a couple of these boughs, and you should find those two bolts.
I have 9 left.
11 would be better.
She laid the crossbow on the ground and picked her way down the slope to vanish in the sunlit green of the undergrowth. Hook cocked the crossbow, winding the cord back easily, hoping that the continual stress would weaken the stave and so help Melisande. Then he went back to lopping branches. He wondered why the king had demanded so many pieces of straight timber the height of a bow stave. Not his business, he decided. He made short work of a second branch, then a third. The great trunk would be sawn eventually, but for the moment he would leave it where it had fallen. He lopped off more of the smaller branches and heard the long collapse of another tree somewhere along the ridge. Pigeons clattered through the leaves. He thought he might have to go and help Melisande find the bolts because she had been gone far too long, but just as he had that thought, she came running back, her face alarmed and her eyes wide. She pointed down the westward slope.
"There are men," she said.
"Of course there are men," Hook said, and sliced off a limb the size of a man's arm with a one-handed stroke of the axe. "We're all over the place."
"Men at arms," Melisande hissed. "Chevalier!"
"Probably our fellows," Hook said.
Mounted men-at-arms patrolled the surrounding countryside every day, looking for supplies and watching for the French army that everyone expected would come to Harfleur's relief.
"They are French," Melisande hissed.
Hook doubted it, but he swung the axe to bury its blade in the fallen trunk, then jumped down and took her arm.
"Let's have a look."
There were indeed men. There were horsemen in a fern-thick gully that twisted through the high wood. Hook could see a dozen of them in single file, following a track through the trees, but he sensed there were more riders behind them. And he saw, too, that Melisande was right. The horsemen were not wearing the Cross of St. George. They had surcoats, but none of the badges was familiar, and the riders were armoured in plate and all wore helmets. They had their visors raised, and Hook could see the leading horseman's eyes glitter in the steel shadow. The man held up his hand to check the column, then stared intently up the slope, trying to discover exactly where the sound of the axe blows came from, and as he stared, so more horsemen appeared from the far trees.
"French," Melisande whispered. "They are,"
Hook said softly. Most of the horsemen carried drawn swords.
"What do you do?"
Melisande asked, still whispering.
"Hide."
"No," Hook said, because he knew what he must do.
The knowledge was instinctive, and he did not doubt it, nor did he hesitate. He led her back to the felled tree, snatched up the cocked crossbow, then ran along the ridge.
"The French!" he shouted. "They're coming! Get back to the wagons, fast!"
He shouted it over and over.
"Back to the wagons!"
He first ran to his right, away from the wagons, to find Tom Scarlet and Will of the Dale standing and staring.
"Will," Hook said, "use Sir John's voice. Tell them the French are here, and get everyone back to the wagons."
Will of the Dale just gaped at him.
"Use Sir John's voice," Hook said harshly, shaking the carpenter by the shoulders. "The goddamn French are coming. Now go! Where's Matt?"
He asked the last question of Tom Scarlet, who mutely pointed southwards.
Will of the Dale was obeying Hook. He was hurrying back along the crest and using his imitation of Sir John's harsh voice to pull the archers back to where the big wagons waited on the road.
Peter Goddington, confused by the mimicry, searched for Sir John and found Hook, Melisande and Tom Scarlet instead.
"What in God's name is happening?" Goddington demanded angrily. "French sergeant," Hook said, pointing down the western slope.
"Don't be daft, Hook," Goddington said. There are no goddamn French here.
I saw them, Hook said.
Men at arms. They're in armour and carrying swords.
They were our men, you fool, Coddington insisted. Probably a forage party.
The sentinel was so sure of himself that Hook was beginning to doubt what he had seen, and his uncertainty was increased because the horsemen, though they must have heard the shouting on the crest, had not reacted. He had expected the men-at-arms to spur up the slope and burst through the trees, but none had appeared. Yet he stuck to his story.
There are about 20 of them, he told Coddington, armoured and with strange livery. Melisande saw them too.
The sergeant glanced at Melisande and decided her opinion was worthless.
I'll have a look, he said grudgingly.
Where did you say they were?
In the trees down the slope, Hook said, pointing. They're not on the road. They're in the trees, like they didn't want to be seen.
You'd better not be dreaming, the sentinel grumbled and went down the slope.
Where's Matt? Hook asked Tom Scarlet again.
He went to look at the sea, Tom Scarlet answered.
Matt! Hook bellowed, cupping his hands.
There was no answer. The warm wind sighed in the branches, and chaffinches made a busy noise somewhere down the eastern slope. A gun sounded from the siege lines, the echo rumbling in the bowl of the hills and melding with the crash of the stone's impact. Hook could not hear the clink of bridles or the thump of hooves, and he wondered if he had imagined the horsemen. The shouting on the crest had ended, suggesting that the bemused archers must have assembled back at the wagons.
"We've never seen the sea before," Tom Scarlet said nervously. "Not before we sailed here. Matt wanted to look again."
"Matt!"
Hook shouted again, but again there was no answer. Peter Coddington had vanished over the crest's lip. Hook gave the crossbow to Melisande and then uncased his bow, strung it, and put an arrow across the stave. He walked to the gully's lip and gazed down into the ferns. Peter Coddington was alone in the gully. There was not a horseman in sight, and the sentinel looked up and gave Hook a glance of pure disgust.
"Nothing here, you fool!" he shouted.
And just then Hook saw the two horsemen come from the trees on the right.
"Behind you!"
he shouted, and Coddington began to run up the slope as Hook raised the bow, hauled the cord back, and loosed just as the man-at-arms nearest the sentinel swerved left. The arrow, a bodkin, glanced off the espalier that armoured the man's shoulder. The sword chopped down, and Hook, as he pulled another arrow from the bag, saw blood bright and sudden in the glowing green woodland. He saw Peter Coddington's head turn red, saw him stumble as the second Frenchman, his sword held rigid as a lance, took the sentinel in the back. Coddington fell. Hook loosed again. The white feathers streaked through shadow and sunlight, and the bodkin head, shafted with oak, slammed through the second man's breastplate and hurled him back in his tall saddle. More horsemen were coming now, spurring from the thick trees to put their horses at the slope, and Tom Scarlet was tugging at Hook's arm.
"Nick! Nick!"
And suddenly it was panic, because there were more riders to their left, between them and the sea, and Hook seized Melisande sleeved and dragged her back. He had not seen that southernmost column, and Hook realized the French had come in at least two parties, and he had seen only one, and he ran desperately, hearing the hooves loud and getting louder. And he dragged Melisande fast to one side, dodging like a hare pursued by hounds. But then a horseman galloped in front of him and slewed about in a slithering flurry of leaf mould. Hook twisted to his left to find refuge by the bole of a great hollow oak. It was really no refuge at all, because he was cornered now, and still more horsemen came, and a rider laughed from his saddle as the men-at-arms surrounded Melisande and the two archers.
"Matt!"
Tom said. And Hook saw that Matthew Scarlet was already a prisoner. A Frenchman in blue and green livery had him by his jacket's collar, dragging him alongside his horse.
"Archers," a horseman said.
The word was the same in French and English, and there was no mistaking the pleasure with which the man spoke.
"Père,"
Melisande gasped.
"Père."
And that was when Hook saw the falcons stooping against the sun. The livery was newly embroidered and bright, almost as bright as the sword blades that reached towards him. The blade came within a hand's breadth of his throat, then suddenly stopped. The rider, sitting straight-legged in his destrier saddle, stared down at Hook. The haunch of a roe deer, newly killed, hung from his saddle's pommel, and its blood dripped onto the scale-armoured foot of the horseman, who was Gilbert Signor de Lonfrel, the Lord of Hell. He was a lord in splendour, mounted on a magnificent stallion and wearing plate armour that shone like the sun. He alone among the horsemen was bareheaded, so that his long black hair hung sleek almost to his waist. His face was like polished metal, hard-edged, bronze dark, with a hawk's nose and hooded eyes that showed amusement as he stared first at Hook, who was trapped by the sword blade, then at Melisande, who had raised the cocked crossbow. If Lanfrel was astonished at discovering his daughter in a high Norman wood, he did not show it. He offered her a flicker of a wry smile, then said something in French, and the girl fumbled in the pouch and took out a bolt that she laid in the weapon's groove. Gilbert, Lord of Lanfrel, could easily have stopped her, but he merely smiled again, as the now loaded weapon was raised once more to point at his face. He spoke much too fast for Hook to understand, and Melisande answered just as fast, but passionately. There was a shout from behind Hook, far behind, from where the road dropped to the English camp. The Lord of Lanfrel gestured to his men, gave an order, and they rode towards the shout. Half of the men, who numbered 18, wore the livery of the Hawk and Sun. The rest had the same blue and green livery as the man holding Matt Scarlet prisoner, and that man, together with a squire wearing Lanfrel's badge, were the only ones who stayed with Le Seigneur d'Enfer.
Three English archers.
Lanfrel spoke in English suddenly, and Hook remembered how this Frenchman had learned English when he was a prisoner waiting for his ransom to be collected.
Three goddamn archers, and I give gold to my men for bringing me the fingers of goddamn archers.
Lanfrel grinned suddenly, his teeth very white against his sun-darkened skin.
There are fingerless peasants all across Normandy and Picardy, because my men cheat.
He seemed proud of that, because he gave a sudden braying laugh.
You know she is my daughter?
I know, Hook said.
She's the prettiest of them. I have 9 that I know of, but only 1 from my wife. But this one, he looked at Melisande, who still held the crossbow on him, this one I sought to protect from the world.
I know, Hook said again.
She was supposed to pray for my soul, Lanfrel said, but it seemed I must breed other daughters if my soul is to be saved.
Melisande spat some fast words that only made Lanfrel smile more.
I put you in the convent, he said, still speaking English, because you were too pretty to be humped by some sweaty peasant and too ill-born to be married to a gentleman. But now it seems you found the peasant anyway.
He gave Hook a derisive glance.
And the fruit is picked, eh? But picked or not, he said, you are still my possession.
She's mine, Hook said, and was ignored.
So what shall I do? Take you back to the nunnery?
Lanfrel asked, then grinned delightedly when Melisande raised the crossbow an inch higher.
You won't shoot, he said.
I will, Hook said.
But it was a barren threat, for he had no arrow on his string and knew he would be given no time to pull one from the bag.
Who do you serve? Lanfrel asked.
Sir John Cornwell, Hook said proudly.
Lanfrel was pleased.
Sir John? Ah, there's a man. His mother must have slept with a Frenchman. Sir John, I like Sir John, he smiled. But what of Melisande, eh? What of my little novice?
I hate it's the convent,
she spat at him, using English. Lanfrel frowned as though her sudden outburst puzzled him.
You were safe there, he said, and your soul was safe.
Safe, Melisande protested. In Soissons? Every nun was raped or killed.
You were raped?
Lanfrel asked, his voice dangerous.
Nicholas stopped him, she said, gesturing at Hook. He killed him first.
The dark eyes brooded on Hook for an instant, then returned to Melisande.
So what do you want? He asked, almost angrily. You want a husband? Someone to look after you? How about him?
Lanfrel jerked his head towards his squire.
Maybe you should marry him. He's gently born, but not too gently. His mother was a saddler's daughter.
The squire, who plainly did not understand a word that was being said, stared dumbly at Melisande. He wore no helmet, but had an avant-air instead, a hood of chain mail that framed a sweaty face scarred by childhood pox. His nose had been flattened in some fight, and he had thick, wet-looking lips. Melisande grimaced and spoke urgently in French, so urgently that Hook only understood part of what she said. She was scornful and tearful at the same time, and her words appeared to amuse her father.
"She says she will stay with you," Lanfrel translated for Hook. "But that depends upon my wishes. It depends on whether I let you live."
Hook was thinking that he could lunge upwards with a bow stave and drive the horn-knocked tip into Lanfrel's throat, or else into the soft tissue under his chin and keep driving the shaft so that it pierced the Frenchman's brain.
"No," the voice spoke in his head.
It was almost a whisper, but unmistakably the voice of St. Crispinian, who had been silent for so long.
"No," the saint said again.
Hook almost fell to his knees in gratitude. His saint had returned. Lanfrel was smiling.
"Are you thinking to attack me, Englishman?"
"Yes," Hook admitted.
"And I would have killed you," Lanfrel said. "And maybe I will anyway."
He stared towards the place where the wagons waited beside the road. Those wagons were hidden by the thick summer foliage, but shouts were loud, and Hook could hear the sharp sound of bowstrings being loosed.
"How many of you are there?" Lanfrel asked.
Hook thought about lying, but decided Lanfrel would discover the truth soon enough.
40 archers," he admitted. "No men-at-arms?"
"None," Hook said. Lanfrel shrugged as if the information were not that important.
"So, you capture Harfleur, and what then? Do you march on Paris? On Rouen? You don't know, but I know. You will march somewhere. Your Henry has not spent all that money to capture one little harbour. He wants more. And when you march, Englishman, we shall be around you and in front of you and behind you, and you will die in ones and twos until there are only a few of you left. And then we shall close on you like wolves on a flock. And will my daughter die because you will be too weak to protect her?"
"I protected her in Soissons," Hook said.
"You didn't."
A tremor of anger showed on Lanfrel's face. The sword tip quivered. But there was also an uncertainty in the Frenchman's eyes.
"I looked for her," he said.
He sounded defensive.
"Not well enough," Hook responded fiercely. "And I found her."
"God led him to me."
Melisande spoke in English for the first time.
"Oh, God?"
Lanfrel had recovered his poise and sounded amused.
"You think God is on your side, Englishman?"
"I know he is," Hook said stoutly.
"And you know what they call me?"
"The Lord of Hell," Hook said. Lanfrel nodded.
"It is a name, Englishman, just a name to frighten the ignorant. But despite that name, I want my soul in heaven when I die. And for that, I need people to pray for me. I need masses said, I need prayers chanted, and I need nuns and priests on their knees." He nodded at Melisande. "Why should she not pray for me?"
"I do," Melisande said.
"But will God listen to her prayers?" Lanfrel asked. "She deserted God for you, and that is her choice. But let us see what God wants, Englishman. Hold up your hand."
He paused, and Hook did not move.
"You want to live?" Lanfrel snarled. "Hold up your hand. Not that one."
He wanted Hook's right hand, the hand with the fingertips hardened to calluses by the friction of the bow's cord. Hook held up his right hand.
"Spread your fingers," Lanfrel ordered,
and moved his sword slowly so that the blade's tip just touched Hook's palm.
"I could kill you," Lanfrel said. "But my daughter likes you, and I have an affection for her. But you took her blood without my permission, and blood demands blood."
He moved his wrist, only his wrist, but so deftly and so strongly that the blade's tip moved an arrow's length in the air, and moved so fast that Hook had no chance to evade before the blade sliced off his smallest finger. The blood welled and ran. Melisande screamed, but did not pull the crossbow's trigger. Hook felt no pain for a heartbeat, then the agony streaked through his arm.
"There," Lanfrel said, amused. "I leave you the fingers for the string, yes, for her sake. But when the wolves close on you, Englishman, you and I shall play our game. If you win, you keep her, but if you lose, she goes to his marriage bed."
He jerked his head at his slack-mouthed squire.
"He's a stinking bed, and he ruts like a boar. He grunts.
Do you agree to our game?
God will give us victory, Hook said. His hand was all pain, but he'd kept the hurt from showing on his face.
Let me tell you something, Lanfarel said, leaning from his saddle. God does not give a cow's wet turd about your king or mine. Do you agree to our game? We fight for Melisande, yes?
Yes, Hook said.
Then put your arrows down, Lanfarel said, and throw your bows away.
Hook understood that the Frenchman did not want an arrow in his back as he rode away, and so he and Tom Scarlet threw their bow staves into the tangled leaves of the felled oak, then dropped their arrow bags.
Lanfarel smiled. We have an agreement, Englishman. The prize is Melisande, but we must seal it with blood, yes?
It is sealed, Hook said, holding up his blood-soaked hand.
We are playing for a life, Lanfarel said, not for blood.
And with that he touched a knee to his stallion, which turned obediently, and the Lord of Hell swept his sword with the swivelling horse, and the blade's tip ripped through Matt Scarlet's throat to fill the greenwood with a spray of red and a jet of blood. And Tom Scarlet cried aloud, and Lanfarel laughed as he spurred eastwards, followed by his two men.
Matt!
Tom Scarlet dropped to his knees beside his twin brother. But Matthew Scarlet was dying as fast as the blood that pumped from his torn and bubbling throat. The hoofbeats faded. There was no more shouting from where the wagons were parked. Melisande was crying. Hook fetched the bows. The French had gone. He used an axe to make a grave under an oak tree, a wide grave, wide enough for Matt Scarlet and Peter Goddington to lie together on the ridge above the sea. Above Harfleur, where the guns tore the walls into rubble. It was hard and ceaseless work. Hook and the archers cut timber and split timber and sawed timber to shore up the gun pits and trenches. New gun pits were made, closer to the town, but the precious weapons had to be protected from Harfleur's defenders, and so the archers constructed thick screens of wooden bulks that stood in front of the cannons' mouths. Each screen was made from oak trunks thick as a girl's waist, and they were sloped backwards so that they would deflect the enemy's missiles skywards. The cleverest thing about the screens, Hook thought, was how they were mounted on frames so that they could swivel. An order was given when a gun was at last ready to fire, and men would turn a great windlass that hauled down the top of the screen and so raised the lower edge to expose the cannon's blackened muzzle. The gun would fire and the world would vanish in a sickening, stinking, thick cloud of smoke that smelled exactly like rotted eggs, and the sound of the gunstone striking the wall would be lost in the echo of the great cannon's bellow. And then the windlass would be released and the screen would thump down to protect the gun and its Dutch gunners again. The enemy had learned to watch for the opening screens and would wait for that moment before shooting their own guns and springalts. So the English guns were also protected by enormous wicker baskets filled with earth and by more timber bulks. And sometimes a screen would be raised even though a gun was not ready to be fired, just to trick the enemy into loosing their missiles, which would thump harmlessly into the baskets and oak trunks. Then, when the gun was ready, the wicker basket immediately in front of the barrel was rolled clear, the screen was raised, and the noise could be heard far up the Lazard's flooded valley. The enemy also possessed cannon, but their guns were much smaller, firing a stone no bigger than an apple and lacking the weight to smash through the heavy screens. Their springalts, giant crossbows that shot thick bolts, had even less power. Hook, delivering a wagon of timber to reinforce the trenches, had a springalt bolt hit one of his horses plumb on the chest. The missile buried itself in the horse's body, ripping through lungs, heart and belly, so that the beast simply collapsed, feet spreading in a sudden pool of blood. The heat shimmered off the blood, and off the flooded land, and off the marshes beside the wide, glittering sea. Trenches defended the besiegers from the enemy's guns and springalts, though there was small defence against the ballista that hurled stones high in the air so that they fell almost vertically. The English had their own catapults made from the timber cut on the slopes above the port, and those machines rained both stones and festering animal corpses into Harfleur. From the hill, Hook could see shattered roofs and two broken church towers. He could see the walls broken open so that the rubble spilled into the ditch, and he could see the giant bastion defending the gate being ripped and frayed and broken and battered. That bastion had been constructed from earth and timber, and the English gunstones chopped and gnawed at its two towers, which flanked a short, thick curtain wall.
"We'll be making a sow next," Sir John told his archers. "Our lord the king is in a hurry."
"There's a great hole in their town wall, Sir John," Thomas Evelgold remarked. He had replaced Peter Goddington as the sentinel.
"And behind that gap is a new wall," Sir John said. "And to attack it, we'd have to get past their barbican."
The barbican was the twin-towered bastion protecting the Lure Gate.
"You want their bastard crossbowmen shooting at you from the side? That barbican has to go, so we'll be making a sow. We'll have to fell more trees. Hook, I want you."
The other archers watched as Sir John took Hook aside.
"There'll be no more French men at arms in the hills," Sir John said. "We've got our own men out there now, and we've got more men watching for a relief force, but they're seeing nothing."
That was a puzzle. August was ending, and still the French had sent no army to relieve the besieged town. English horsemen rode every day to scout the roads from the north and the east, but the country stayed empty. Sometimes a small force of French men at arms challenged the patrols, but there was no cloud of dust to betray a marching army.
"So tell me what you did on the ridge," Sir John said. "The day poor Peter Goddington died."
"I just warned our fellows," Hook said.
"No, you didn't. You told them to get back to the wagons, is that right?"
"Yes, Sir John."
"Why?" Sir John asked belligerently.
Hook frowned as he remembered. At the time, it had seemed an obvious precaution, but he had not thought why it was so obvious.
"Our bows were no good in the trees," he now said slowly. "But if they were back at the wagons, they could shoot. They needed space to shoot."
"Which is just what happened," Sir John said.
The archers gathering at the wagons had driven the raiders away with two volleys.
"So you did the right thing, Hook. The bastards only came to make mischief. They wanted to kill a few men and have a look at what progress we were making, and you saw them off."
"I wasn't there, Sir John," Hook said. "It was the other archers what drove them off."
"You were with the Sieur of Longferel, I know, and he let you live."
Sir John gave Hook an appraising look.
"Why?"
"He wants to kill me later,"
Hook said, not sure that was the right answer.
"Or maybe it was because of Melisande."
"He's a cat," Sir John said, "and you're his mouse, a wounded mouse."
He glanced at Hook's right hand, which was still bandaged.
"You can still shoot."
"Good as ever, Sir John."
"So, I'm making you a ventinor, which means I'm doubling your pay."
"Me?"
Hook stared at Sir John. Sir John did not answer straight away. He turned a critical eye on his men-at-arms, who were practicing sword strokes against tree trunks. Practice, practice, practice was one of Sir John's constant refrains. He claimed to strike 1,000 blows a day in never-ending practice, and he demanded the same of his men.
"Put some muscle into it, Ralph," he shouted at one man, then turned back to Hook. "Did you think about what to do when you saw the French?"
"No."
"That's why I'm making you a sergeant. I don't want men who have to think about what to do, but just do it. Tom Evelgold's now your sentinel, so you can take his company. I tell him what to do, he tells you what to do, and you tell your archers what to do. If they don't do it, you thump the bastards, and if they still don't do it, I thump you."
"Yes, Sir John."
Sir John's battered face grinned.
"You're good, young Hook, and you're something else."
He pointed at Hook's bandaged hand.
"You're lucky. Here."
He took a thin silver chain from a pouch and dropped it into Hook's hand.
"Your badge of office. And tomorrow, you build a sow."
"What's a sow, Sir John?"
"It's a pig to build, I'll tell you that much," Sir John said. "A goddamn pig."
It began to rain that night. The rain came from the sea, carried on a cold west wind. It began softly, pattering on the besiegers' tents, and then the wind rose to tear at the banners on their makeshift poles, and the rain hardened and came at an angle and drenched the ground into a morass of mud. The floodwaters, which had largely subsided, began to rise again, and the midden overflowed. The gunners cursed and raised awnings over their weapons, while every archer carefully hid his bowstrings from the soaking rain. There was no need for Hook to carry a bow. His job was to raise the sow, and it was, as Sir John had promised, a pig of a job. It was not intricate work, not even skilled, but it needed strength, and it had to be done in full view of the defenders and within range of their cannons, springalts, catapults and crossbows.
The sow was a giant shield shaped like the toe of a shoe, behind and beneath which men could work safe from enemy missiles, and it would have to be built strong enough to withstand the repeated strike of gunstones. A white-haired Welshman, Dafydd ap Trychan, supervised the work.
"I come from Pontygwaith," he told the archers. "And in Pontygwaith, we know more about building things than all you miserable English bastards put together."
He had planned to run two wagons loaded with earth and stones to the place where the sow would be built, and to use the wagons to protect the archers from enemy missiles. But the rain had softened the ground, and the wagon had become bogged down.
"We'll have to dig," he said with the relish of a man who knew he would not have to wield a spade himself. "We know about digging in Pontygwaith. No more than all you English fart-makers put together." "That's because you were digging graves for all the Welshmen we killed," Will o' the Dale retorted. "Baron Eustace we were," Dafydd ap Trychan replied happily.
Later, as he chatted with Hook, he cheerfully admitted he had been a rebel against the English king just 15 years before.
"Now that Owain Glyndwr," he said warmly, "what a man."
"What happened to him?"
"He's still alive, boy," Dafydd ap Trychan said. "Still alive."
Glyndwr's rebellion had burned for over a decade, giving young Henry, Prince of Wales and now King of England, a long education in warfare. The revolt had been defeated, and some of the Welsh leaders had been dragged on hurdles through London to their execution, but Owain Glyndwr himself had never been captured.
"We have magicians in Wales," Dafydd ap Trychan lowered his voice and leaned close to Hook as he spoke. "And they can turn a man invisible."
"I'd like to see that," Hook said wistfully.
"Well, you can't, can you? That's the whole thing about being invisible. You can't see them. Why, Owain Glyndwr could be right here now, and you couldn't see him. And that's what has happened to him, see? He's living in luxury, boy, with women and apples. But if an Englishman gets within a mile of him, he turns invisible."
"So what's a rebel Welshman doing with this army?" Hook asked.
"A man has to live," Dafydd ap Trychan said. "And eating an enemy's loaf of bread is better than staring into an empty oven. There's dozens of Glyndwr's men in this army, boy, and we'll fight as hard for Henry as we ever did for Owain."
He grinned.
"Mind you, there are a few of Owain Glyndwr's men in France as well, and they'll fight against us."
"Archers?"
"God be praised, no. Archers can't afford to run away to France, can they now? No, it's the gentry who lost their land who went to France, not the archers. Have you ever faced an archer in battle?"
"God be praised, no," Hook said.
"It is not what I would call a happy experience," Dafydd ap Trychan said grimly. "My God, boy, but we Welsh don't take fright easily. But when Henry's archers shot at Shrewsbury, it was death from the sky. Like hail, it was only hail with steel points, and hail that never stopped, and men were dying all around me, and their screams were like tortured gulls on a black shore. An archer is a terrible thing."
"I'm an archer."
"You're a digger now, boy," Dafydd ap Trychan said, grinning. "So dig."
They dug a trench away from a gun pit, digging it towards the walls of Harfleur, and the defenders saw the trench being made and rained crossbow bolts and gunstones on the work. The defenders' catapults tried to lob stones onto the new trench, but the missiles went wide, landing in showers of splattering mud. After 30 paces of new trench had been made, Dafydd ap Trychan declared himself satisfied and ordered a new pit to be excavated. It had to be big, square and deep, and so the archers hacked and shovelled till they reached a layer of chalk. The new pit's side seeped water so that they slopped about in muck as they raised a parapet of tree trunks on three sides of the pit, only leaving the rear that led to the English camp unprotected. They laid the trunks flat, four abreast, and piled more on top, so that a man could stand upright in the pit and be invisible to the enemy on Harfleur's walls.
"Tonight," Dafydd ap Trychan said, "we'll make a roof and our lovely sow will be finished."
They made the roof at night because the pit was close enough to the walls to be within easy range of a crossbow, but the enemy must have guessed what was happening, and they shot blind through the rain-soaked darkness, and three men were wounded by the short, sharp bolts that spat from the night. It took all that night to lay long trunks over the pit, and then to cover those timbers with a thick layer of earth and chalk rubble before adding a final covering of more tree trunks.
"And now the real work begins,"
Dafydd Ap Trahan said, which means we have to use Welshmen.
The real work? Hook asked.
We're going to make a mine, lad. We're going to dig deep.
The rain ended at dawn. A chill wind came from the west, and the rain slid away across France, and the sun fought against cloud as the enemy gunners hammered the newly made sow with gunstones that wasted their powder on the thick log parapet. Hook and his archers slept, sheltering under the crude cabins they had made from tree boughs, earth and ferns. When Hook woke, he found Melisande scrubbing his mail coat with sand and vinegar.
Rui, she said in explanation.
Rust.
That's what I said.
You can polish my coat, darling, Will of the Dale said as he crawled from his shelter.
Do your own, William, Melisande said. I cleaned Tom's, though.
Well done, Hook said.
All the archers were worried about Thomas Scarlet, whose customary cheerfulness had been buried with his twin brother. Scarlet scowled these days, or else sat by himself brooding.
All he wants, Hook said quietly, is to meet your father again.
Then Thomas will die, Melisande said bleakly.
He loves you, Hook said.
My father?
He let you live. He let you stay with me.
He lets you live too, she said, almost resentfully.
I know.
She paused. Her grey eyes watched our Fleur, which was ringed with gun smoke like a sea fog shrouding a cliff. Hook put his wet boots to dry beside the campfire. The burning wood spat and shot sparks. It was Willow, and Willow always protested against burning.
He loves my mother, I think,
Melisande said wistfully. Did he?
She was beautiful, Melisande said, and she loved him. She said he was so beautiful too, a beautiful man.
Handsome, Hook allowed.
Beautiful,
Melisande insisted. When you met him in the trees, Hook asked, did you want him to take you away?
She gave an abrupt shake of her head.
No, she said. I think he is a bad angel, and I think he is in my head like the saint is in yours.
She turned to look at him.
And I wish he would go away.
You think about him, is that it?
I always wanted him to love me, she said harshly, and started scouring the mail again. No, no.
She was angry. She was angry, and for a while she said nothing, then relented.
Life is hard, Nicholas, you know that. It is work and work and work and worry where the food will come from, and it is more work. And a lord, any lords, can stop all that. They can wave their hand, and there is no more work, no more worry. Just facile.
Easy.
And I wanted that.
Tell him you want that.
He is beautiful, Melisande said. But he is not kind. I know that. And I love you. Je t'aime.
She said the last words decidedly, without apparent affection, but Hook was struck dumb by them. He watched archers bringing firewood to the camp. Melisande grimaced with the effort of scrubbing the sand on the mail coat.
Do you know of Sir Robert Knowles? She asked suddenly.
Course I do, Hook said.
Every archer knew of Sir Robert, who died rich not many years before.
He was an archer once, Melisande said.
That's how he started, Hook agreed, wondering how Melisande knew of the legendary Sir Robert.
And he became a knight, Melisande said. He led armies. And now Sir John has made you a Ventnor.
A Ventnor isn't a knight, Hook said, smiling.
But Sir Robert was a Ventnor once, Melisande said fiercely. And then he became a sentinel, and then a man-at-arms, and after that a knight, Alice told me. And if he could do it, why not you?
That vision was so astonishing that Hook could only stare at her for a moment.
Me? A man-at-arms? He finally said.
Why not?
I'm not born to that.
Nor was Sir Robert.
Well, it does happen, Hook said dubiously.
He knew of other archers who had led companies and become rich. Sir Robert was the most famous, but archers also remembered Thomas of Hookton, who had died as Lord of 1,000 Acres.
But it doesn't happen often, Hook went on, and it takes money.
And what is war to you men but money? They talk without end of prisoners, of ransoms.
Melisande pointed her brush at him and grinned mischievously.
Capture my father. We'll ransom him. We'll take his money.
You like that, would you? Hook asked.
Yes, she said vengefully. I would like that.
Hook tried to imagine being rich, of receiving a ransom that would be more than most men could earn in a lifetime, and then he forgot that dream as John Fletcher, who was one of the older archers and a man who had shown some resentment at Hook's promotion, suddenly flinched and ran towards the midden trench. Fletcher's face looked pale.
Fletch is ill, Hook said.
And poor Alice was horribly sick this morning,
Melisande said, wrinkling her nose in distaste.
Le diary!
Hook decided he did not want to hear more about Alice Godwin's sickness, and he was saved from further details by Sir John Cornwell's arrival.
Are we awake? The knight bellowed. Are we awake and breathing?
We are now, Sir John, Hook answered for the archers.
Then down to the trenches, down to the trenches! Let's get this goddamn siege done!
Hook donned his damp boots and half-scrubbed mail, pulled on his helmet and surcoat, then went to the trenches. The siege went on. The sow shuddered each time a gunstone struck its sloping face. The logs that formed the face were battered, split, and bristling with springalp bolts, but the enemy's missiles had failed to break the heavy shield or even weaken it, and beneath the layers of timber and earth, the Welsh miners went to work. Other shafts were being driven on our Fleur's eastern side, where the Duke of Clarence's forces were camped, and from both east and west the guns roared and the stones clawed at the walls. The mangonels and trebuchets dropped boulders into the town, smoke and dust erupted and plumed from the narrow streets, while the mines crept towards the ramparts. The eastern shafts were being driven under the walls, where great caverns, shored with timber, would be clawed out of the chalk, and when the time came, the timber supports would be burned away so that the caverns would collapse and bring down the ramparts above. The western mine, its entrance guarded by the sow Hook had helped make, was intended to tunnel under the vast battered bastion that protected the Lure Gate. Bring the barbican down, and the English army could attack the breach beside the gate without any danger of being assaulted on their flank by the barbican's garrison. So the Welshmen dug and the archers guarded their sow and the town suffered. The barbican had been made from great oak trunks that had been sunk into the earth and then hooped with iron. The trunks had formed the outline of two squat round towers joined by a brief curtain wall, and their interior had been rammed with earth and rubble, the whole protected by a flooded ditch facing the besiegers. The English guns had splintered the nearest timbers so that the earth had spilled out to make a steep, unstable ramp that filled one part of the ditch, yet still the bastion resisted. Its ruin was manned by crossbowmen and men-at-arms, and its banners hung defiantly from what remained of its wooden ramparts. Each night, when the English guns ceased fire, the defenders made repairs, and the dawn would reveal a new timber palisade, and the guns would have to begin their slow work of demolition again. Other guns fired at the town itself. When Hook had first seen Harfleur, it had looked almost magical to him, a town of tight roofs and church steeples all girdled by a white, tower-studded wall that had glowed in the August sun. It had looked like the painted town in the picture of St. Crispin and St. Crispinian in Soissons Cathedral, the picture he had stared at for so long as he said his prayers. Now the painted town was a battered heap of stones, mud, smoke and shattered houses. Long stretches of the wall still stood and still flaunted their derisive banners that displayed the badges of the garrison's leaders, images of the saints and invocations to God, but eight of the towers had been collapsed into the town ditch, and one long length of rampart had been beaten into wreckage close to the Lure Gate. The great missiles lobbed into the town by the catapults smashed houses and started fires, so that a pall of smoke hung constantly above the besieged town. A church steeple had fallen, taking its bells in a mighty cacophony, and still the boulders and gunstones hammered at the already hammered town. And still the defenders fought back. Each dawn, Hook led men into the pits that defended the English guns, and in every dawn he saw where the garrison had been working. They were making a new wall behind the broken rampart, and they shored up the collapsing barbican with new timbers. English heralds, holding their white wands and gaudy in their coloured coats, rode to the enemy walls to offer terms, but the enemy commanders rebuffed the heralds each time.
"What they're hoping," Father Christopher told Hook one early September morning, "is that their king will lead an army to their rescue."
"I thought the French king was mad."
"Oh, so he is. He believes he is made of glass," Father Christopher said mockingly.
The priest visited the trenches every morning, offering blessings and jests to the archers.
It's true. He thinks he's made of glass and will shatter if he falls. He also chews rugs and tells his troubles to the moon.
So he won't be leading any army here, Father, Hook said, smiling.
But the Mad King has sons, Hook, and they're all bloodthirsty little scum. Any one of them would love to grind our bones to powder.
Will they try?
God knows, Hook. God alone knows, and he isn't telling me. But I do know there's an army gathering at Rouen.
Is that far?
See that road?
The priest pointed to the faint remains of a road that had once led from the Lure Gate, but which was now only a scar in a muddy, missile-battered landscape.
Follow that, Father Christopher said, and turn right when it reaches the hill and keep going, and after 50 miles you'll find a great bridge and a huge city. That's Rouen, Hook. 50 miles. An army can march that in 3 days.
So they come, Hook said, and we'll kill them.
King Harold said much the same just before Hastings, Father Christopher said gently.
Did Harold have archers? Hook asked.
Just men-at-arms, I think.
Well then, Hook said and grinned.
The priest raised his head to peer at Harfleur.
We should have captured the place by now, he said wistfully. It's taking much too long.
He turned because a passing man-at-arms had greeted him cheerfully. Father Christopher returned the greeting and made a sketchy sign of blessing towards the hurrying man.
You know who that was, Hook?
Hook looked at the retreating figure who wore a bright surcoat of red and white.
No, Father, no idea.
Geoffrey Chaucer's son, the priest said proudly.
Who?
You've not heard of Geoffrey Chaucer? Father Christopher asked. The poet?
Oh, I thought he might be someone useful, Hook said, then slammed a hand onto the priest's shoulder and so forced him to crouch.
A heartbeat later, a crossbow bolt slapped into the muddy back of the trench where Father Christopher had been standing.
That's Catface, Hook explained. He's useful. Catface?
A bastard on the barbican, Father. He's got a face like a polecat. I can see him raise his bow.
You can't shoot him.
20 paces too far off, Father, Hook said, and peered between 2 battered wicker baskets filled with disintegrating earth that formed the parapet.
He waved, and a figure on the bastion waved back.
I always let him know I'm still living.
Polecat, Father Christopher said musingly. You know Rob Pole is ill?
So's Fletch. And Dick Godwin's wife.
Alice, is she sick too?
Horrible, I hear.
Rob Pole can't stop shitting, the priest said. And nothing but blood and mucky water comes out.
God help us, Hook said. Fletch is the same.
I'd better start praying, Father Christopher said earnestly. We can't lose men to sickness. Are you feeling well?
I am.
God be praised for that. And your hand? How's your hand?
It throbs, Father, Hook said, holding up his right hand, which was still bandaged.
Melisande had covered the wound with honey, then wrapped it.
Throbbing is a good sign, the priest said. He leaned forward and sniffed at the bandage. And it smells good. Well, it stinks of blood, sweat and shit, but so do we all. It doesn't smell rotten, and that's the important thing. How's your piss? Is it cloudy? Strong-coloured? Feeble?
Just normal, Father.
That's grand, Hook. We can't lose you.
And strange to tell, Hook thought, but he reckoned the priest was telling the truth because he knew he was doing his Ventnor's job well. He had expected to be embarrassed by the small authority and had feared that some of the older men would deliberately ignore his orders, but if there was any resentment, it was muted and his commands were obeyed readily enough. He wore the silver chain with pride. The weather had turned hot again, baking the mud into a crust that crumbled into fine dust with every footstep. Harfleur crumbled too, yet still the garrison defied the besiegers. The king would come to the archers' pits 4 or 5 times a day and stare at the ramparts. At the beginning of the siege, he chatted with the archers, but now his face was drawn and his lips thin, and the archers gave him and his small entourage space. They watched him stare, and they could read from his scarred face that he did not think an assault could break through the new inner walls. Any such attack would have to stumble over the ruins of the burned houses, suffer the bolts spitting from the barbican, then cross the great town ditch before climbing the wreckage of the gun-shattered wall, and all the time the crossbow bolts would slash in from the flanks. and once across the wall's ruins, the attackers would be faced with a new inner wall that was made from thick baskets of earth and from bulks of timber and stones fetched from the falling buildings inside the town. "We need another length of wall down," Hook overheard the king say, "and then we attack instantly into the new breach."
"Can't be done, sire," Sir John Cornwall said grimly. "This is the only dry approach we've got."
The floodwaters had receded, but they still ringed much of the town, restricting the English attack to the two places where the mine shafts were being hacked towards the town.
"Then bring down the barbican," the king insisted, "and beat the gate beyond into splinters."
He stared, long-nosed and grim-faced, at the stubborn barbican, then suddenly became aware of the anxious archers and men-at-arms watching him.
"God didn't bring us this far to fail," he shouted confidently. "The town will be ours, fellows, and soon. There will be ale and good food. It will all be ours soon."
All day the chalk and soil was dragged from the mine shaft while the timbers, cut to a bowstave's length, were carried inside to support the tunnel. The guns kept up their fire, shrouding the besiegers' lines with smoke, punching their eardrums with noise and pounding the already pounded defenders.
"How are your ears?" Sir John greeted Hook on an early September morning.
"My ears, Sir John."
"Those ugly things on the sides of your head?"
"Nothing wrong with them, Sir John."
"Then come with me."
Sir John, his fine armour and surcoat covered in dust, led Hook back through a trench and so to the mine's entrance beneath the sow. The shaft sloped sharply down for 15 paces, then the tunnel levelled. It was 2 paces wide and as high as a bow stave. Rushlights burned from small brackets nailed to the timber supports, but as Hook followed Sir John he noted how the small flames grew feebler the deeper they went. Every few paces Sir John stopped and flattened himself against the tunnel side, and Hook did the same to let some miner pass with a load of excavated chalk. Dust hung in the air, while the floor was a slurry of water and chalk dust.
"All right, boys," Sir John said when he reached the tunnel's end. "Time to rest. Everyone stay still and silent."
The far end of the tunnel was lit by horn-shielded lanterns hanging from the last beam to be propped into place. 2 miners had been using pickaxes on the tunnel's face, and they gratefully put down their tools and sank to the floor as Dafydd ap Trychan, supervising the work, nodded a greeting to Hook. Sir John crouched near the grey-haired Welshman and motioned for Hook to squat.
"Listen," Sir John hissed.
Hook listened. A miner coughed.
"Shh," Sir John said.
Sometimes in the long woods that fell from Lord Slayton's pastures to the river, Hook would stand quite motionless, just listening. He knew every sound of those trees, whether it was a deer's hooffall, a boar snuffling, a woodpecker drumming, the clack of a raven's bill as it preened its feathers, or just the wind in the leaves, and from those sounds his ear would find the discordant note, the signal that told him a trespasser was prowling the undergrowth. Now he listened in just the same way, ignoring the breathing of the half-dozen men, letting his mind wander, just allowing the silence to fill his head and so alert him to the smallest disturbance. He listened a long time.
"My ears ring all the time," Sir John whispered. "I think because I've got beaten on the helmet with blades too much and..."
Hook held up an impatient hand, unaware that he was ordering a knight of the garters to silence. Sir John obeyed anyway. Hook listened, heard something and then heard it again.
"Someone's digging," he said. "Oh, the bastards," Sir John said quietly. "Are you sure?"
Now that he had identified the sound, Hook was surprised no one else could hear the rhythmic thunk of picks striking chalk. The garrison was making a countermine, driving their own tunnel towards the besiegers in hope of intercepting the English tunnel before it could be finished.
"Maybe 2 tunnels, Hook said.
The sound was slightly irregular, as if 2 mismatched rhythms were mixing.
"That's what I thought," Dafydd ap Trychan said, "but I wasn't sure. The ears play tricks underground, they do." "Busy little bastards, aren't they?" Sir John said vengefully. He looked at Dafydd ap Trychan. "How far to go?"
20 paces, Sir John. Say 2 days. Another 2 to make the chamber, 1 to fill it with incendiaries.
"They're still a long way off," Sir John said. "Maybe they won't find this tunnel."
"They'll be listening too, Sir John. And the closer they get, the clearer they hear us."
"Putrid, stinking, prickless, rancid bastards,"
Sir John said to no one in particular. He nodded at Hook.
"I still can't hear them."
"They're there,"
Hook said confidently. They spoke in whispers, shrouded by a darkness scarce relieved by the rushlight lanterns flickering in the foul air. One of the miners spoke in Welsh. Dafydd ap Trychan silenced him with a cautionary hand.
"He's worried what happens if the enemy break into the tunnel, Sir John."
"Make a chamber here," Sir John said, "big enough for 6 or 7 men. We'll have archers and men-at-arms standing guard here. Have your own weapons at hand, but for the moment keep digging. Let's bring that bastard Barbican down."
The mineshaft was aiming for the northernmost tower of the obstinate bastion in hope of tumbling it to fill the flooded ditch. A cavern would be made beneath the tower, a cavern supported by timber bulks that would be burned away so that the roof would collapse, and with it, the tower. Sir John slapped the miners on their shoulders.
"Well done, boys," he said. "God is with you."
He beckoned to Hook, and the two of them went back towards the sow.
"I hope to God he is with us," Sir John grumbled,
then stopped and frowned as he contemplated the tunnel's entrance.
"We'll have to put some defences here," he said.
"In the sow.
If the bastards break into our tunnel, Hook, they'll come swarming out of that hole like rats smelling a free breakfast. We'll put a wall here and garrison it with archers."
Hook watched two men carrying pit supports into the tunnel.
"A wall here will slow the work, Sir John," he said.
"God damn you, Hook, I know that," Sir John snapped, then gazed at the tunnel's mouth. "We need to end this siege. It's gone on too long. Men are getting sick. We need to be away from this stinking place."
"Barrels," Hook suggested.
"Barrels," Sir John echoed with another snarl.
"Fill 3 or 4 barrels with stones and soil," Hook said patiently. "And if the French come, just roll the barrels into the entrance and stand them upright. 6 archers can take care of any bastard that tries to get past them."
Sir John stared at the entrance for a few heartbeats, then nodded.
"Your mother wasn't wasting her time when she spread her thighs, Hook. Good man. I want the barrels in place by sundown."
The barrels were in place by dusk. Hook, waiting to be relieved, went to the trench beside the sow and watched the broken walls that were lit red by the sun sinking beyond the tree-stripped hills. Behind him, in the English camp, a man played a flute plaintively, repeating the same phrase over and over as though trying to get it right. Hook was tired. He wanted to eat and sleep, nothing more, and he paid small attention as a man-at-arms came to stand beside him at the parapet. The man was wearing a close-fitting helmet that half-shadowed his face, but otherwise had no armour, just a leather jerkin, but his muddied boots were well-made, and a golden chain at his neck denoted his high status.
"Is that a dead dog?" the man asked,
nodding towards a furry corpse lying halfway between the English forward trench and the French barbican. 3 ravens were pecking at the dead beast.
"The French shoot them," Hook said. "The dogs run out of our lines and the crossbowmen shoot them, and they vanish in the night."
"The dogs?"
"They're food for the French," Hook explained curtly. "Fresh meat."
"Ah, of course," the man said.
He watched the ravens for a while.
"I've never eaten dog."
"Tastes a bit like hair," Hook said, "but stringier."
And he glanced at the man and saw the deep pitted scar beside the long nose.
"Sire," he added hastily, and dropped to one knee. "Stand up, stand up," the king said.
He stared at the barbican, which now resembled little more than a heap of earth with a wall of battered tree trunks rammed into its crumbling forward slope.
"We must take that barbican," he said absently, speaking to himself.
Hook was watching the bastion, looking for the telltale flicker of movement that would warn him of a crossbowman taking aim. But he reckoned the king was safe enough because the French usually went quiet as the sun sank beneath the western horizon, and this evening was no different. The guns and catapults of both sides were silent.
"I remember the first day of the siege," the king said, sounding almost puzzled. "And the church bells were always ringing in the town. I thought they were being defiant. Then I realized they were burying their dead. But they don't ring anymore."
"Too many dead, sire," Hook said awkwardly. "Or maybe there's no bells left."
There was something about talking to a king that made his thoughts stumble.
"It must be ended quickly," the king said earnestly, then stepped back from the parapet. "Does the saint still speak to you?" he asked,
and Hook was so astonished that the king remembered him that he said nothing, just nodded hastily.
"That's good," Henry said, "because if God is on our side, then nothing can prevail against us. Remember that."
He gave Hook a half smile.
"And we will prevail,"
Henry added softly, almost as though he spoke to himself. Then he walked down the trench leading back to the sow where a dozen men waited for him. Hook went to bed. Next morning, when a gun fired, the earth trembled. Hook was in the mine, down at the lowest level, where Sir John had led him to listen again, and suddenly the earth shuddered, and the rushlights flickered dark. Everyone crouched in the half-dark, listening. A miner began coughing wetly, and Hook waited until the echo of the cough had died away, listening, listening for death, listening. A second gun fired, and the earth seemed to quiver as the tiny flame spluttered again, and dust jarred from the roof, and gobbets of earth spattered down to splash in the tunnel slurry. The rumble of the gun's noise seemed to last forever, and there was a moaning sound, a creaking as though the oaken supports were bending under the weight of the earth they carried. "Hook?" Sir John asked. There was a scratching noise, so faint that Hook wondered if he imagined it, but then there was a muffled crack followed by silence. After a while the scratching started again, and this time Hook was sure he heard it. The men in the tunnel watched him anxiously. He crossed to the farther wall and pressed an ear against the chalk. Scratching. Hook looked at Dafydd ap Trychan. "How are you digging now, sir?" he asked.
"The way we always do," the Welshman said, puzzled. "Show me, sir."
The Welshman took a pick and went to the tunnel's face, where instead of swinging the pick to bury its blade in the soft rock, he dragged it down a natural cleft. He dragged it again, deepening the cleft, and then pushed the blade into the hole and tried to lever out a chunk of stone. But the hole was not deep enough, and so he scratched the steel point down the groove again. He scratched it. He was working quietly, trying not to alert the French as the tunnel went closer to the ravaged walls. And Hook realized that was the sound he was hearing. Both teams of tunnelers were trying to work silently.
"They're very close," Hook said.
"Come with me, O Argaluid," a miner muttered and crossed himself.
"How close?" Sir John demanded, ignoring the plea for God's help.
"Can't tell, Sir John."
"God damn the goddamn bastards," Sir John spat.
"They may be above us," Dafydd ap Trychan suggested. "Or below."
"You'll know when they're really close," Hook said. "You'll hear the scratching loud."
"Scratching?" the Welshman asked.
"It's what I hear, sir."
"They'll hack their way through the last few feet," Dafydd ap Trychan said grimly, "and come on us like demons."
"We have our own demons waiting for them," Sir John said. "We're not abandoning this tunnel, we need it. We'll fight the bastards underground. It'll save us digging them graves, won't it?"
The war bows were too long to use in the tunnel, and so at midday Sir John bought a half dozen crossbows.
"If they break in," he told Hook, "greet them with these, then use your poleaxes."
The scratching was louder, so loud that Dafydd ap Trychan decided there was no longer any purpose in trying to be silent, and so his men began to swing their pickaxes, filling the tunnel's end with noise and a fine choking dust. Every now and then a blade would strike flint and a spark would fly fierce and bright across the gloomy shaft. The sparks looked like shooting stars, and Hook remembered his grandmother crossing herself whenever she saw such a star. Then she would say a prayer, and she claimed such prayers, carried by the hurrying stars, were more effective. He closed his eyes when the sparks flew, and prayed for Melisande and for Father Christopher and for his brother Michael. Michael, at least, was in England, far from the Peril brothers and their mad priest father.
"Another day's work," Dafydd ap Trychan said, interrupting Hook's thoughts of home. "And we can start making the cavern. Then we'll bring down their tower like the walls of Jericho."
The men-at-arms and the archers sat at the tunnel's edge, drawing in their feet to let the labourers carry out the excavated spoil and bring in the new timbers to support the roof. They listened to the sounds of the French miners. Those noises were louder, inescapable and ominous. They came from the north where the enemy had to be driving a countermine to intercept the English work and, in the dust-shrouded light of the small flames, Hook constantly watched the far wall, expecting to see a great hole appear through which an armoured enemy would erupt. Sir John spent much of the afternoon in the tunnel, his sword drawn and face shadowed.
"We have to fight them back into their hole," he said, "and then collapse their work. Jesus, it smells like a midden down here."
"It is a midden," Dafydd ap Trychan said.
Some of the labourers had fallen ill and constantly fouled the wet slurry underfoot. Sir John left late in the day, and an hour later sent other men to relieve the mine's guards.
Those new men came stooping down the tunnel, their shadows flickering monstrously in the half-darkness.
"Christ on his cross," a voice grumbled. "Can't breathe this air."
"You have crossbows for us," another voice demanded.
"We've got them," Hook acknowledged, "and they're cocked."
"Leave them for us," the man said, then peered at the archers he was relieving.
End of Disc 5.